Welcome to The Atypical Leader with Rick Brennan, where we talk about harnessing what makes you unique
and maybe even a little odd,
while at the same time dismantling the notion that you have to be a certain type of person or act a certain way to be an effective leader.
You're definitely a leader, not a follower.
I like the sound of this.
It's time for us atypical leaders to come out of the shadows and learn to be proud and confident in what makes us different.
I'm proud of who I am.
I'm proud of who I am.
Atypical Leader starts now.
How you doing, Judy?
I'm good. I'm good, sir. How are you?
Good. I hear you just had a big scoff of oysters.
I did. I'm on the West Coast. I'm on Hornby Island visiting my friend Maureen and her partner Max. And he just deep fried a bunch of oysters up. It was quite lovely.
Deep fried.
And they were delicious.
Were they delicious? How do I say this? Well, I might as well just come out and ask you, don't oysters make you horny?
You mean, are they used as an aphrodisiac?
No, I mean, do they make you horny? Because, I mean, Christ, you're on Hornby Island. I'm eating oysters on Hornby Island. I'm all horned up. So what the hell are you doing? It sounds like a resort in Jamaica. Hornby Island.
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't the right place with the right person at the right time. I was with my sister and one of my best friends. So, you know, you don't really go into it with that thought in mind. Now, if you're sitting in a nice restaurant and you have beautiful oysters and a glass of wine and you've got the perfect man across from you.
Oh, you see a guy, in the corner of your eye sitting at another table?
Exactly.
Has that ever happened to you? You ever get carried away? Oh, a pause. A pause says a lot.
Now, don't go down that. Don't go down there.
So it's too personal? Too personal?
Don't go down
there. Okay, no, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to. It's just when I thought of horny and Hornby Island, I thought, you know.
Well, I think aphrodisiac is a nicer word.
Okay, just thought I'd ask. Anyways.
Okay. Glad you wanted to know.
Just for the inquiry mind. So you're doing a little trip around northern BC, is it?
No, we were in Vancouver, well, South Surrey. Then we went over to Bamfield, which was quite an experience. And now we're on Hornby Island. Bamfield was so fucking cold. Oh, my God. Cold, rainy. We went out in a boat ride. I just about froze my ass off, but it was good. It's a beautiful little town. So what have you been up to?
Well, you know, since I got to Costa Rica, I was kind of sick. I've had some stomach issues and stuff like that. And, you know,
so that's not good. Fighting,
you know, but, you know, it's the type of thing I've had forever. And, you know, it's going to lead us into our podcast today is I've had stomach issues for whatever. And it's,
are you feeling better?
Oh, yes, I'm better now. I'm back to square one, doing good, eating good, exercising, all doing all the things that help my brain, or I should say my stomach, feel better.
I don't know if we've ever talked about it, but I've been going to a master herbalist in Calgary for years, actually. It started when I was in my late 20s. Well, actually, I've had it all my life, and my mom had taken me to a million doctors, and they couldn't figure out what was going on because I got migraines and I got nausea and I got sick. And so finally, I decided to go to a master herbalist. She put me on a regimen and I've been going to her ever since. And she just, I don't have that problem.
When I think about back to my life and when I was in my much younger days, and I was always hungover significantly when I ever drank and, you know, always had stomach issues. And I know I suffered from brain fog and anxiety, and I never really associated, never brought the two things together. And it's only later in life that I realized how gluten impacted me, or lectin or milk or any dairy product, that I start to make that connection between the food I eat and the way I feel. And the way I feel has a lot to do with how effectively my brain works, how I can communicate, how I deal with anxiety, all those type of things.
So hopefully today when we talk to our guest, we will learn a lot more of how food affects the brain.
I'm looking forward to today to understand really more concretely how what you eat impacts the way the brain works. It's great to say that, but what the hell does that mean? So Heather, how are things in Moncton?
Things are good.
Thanks a lot for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're looking forward to this.
Me too.
I listened to one of your podcasts. It was very interesting. I think it was the first one.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Just wanted to find out a bit more about you. It was interesting.
Heather, could you introduce yourself?
So a little bit about myself. I worked in the corporate world as my first career from 91 to 2004. And I managed people in call center environments. I worked in the call center environment. I was involved in credit and collections. I was involved in customer service. So I had the I'm hungry now diet. I had the experience of having health issues because of that diet and that lifestyle that was the proverbial treadmill. In 2004, I had the, I guess, intuition that I needed to quit my job. I had had a boyfriend at the time suggest that I quit my job, and I wasn't listening to him, but I did. Then I was of the mindset to kind of do the eat, pray, love thing. That was very popular at the time. And that amounted to registering for the School of Natural Nutrition. That year transformed my life and my awareness of food, the impact of lifestyle, the impact of our choices, the impact of how listening to our intuition would be beneficial in terms of how our life unfolds. After my year was done, I looked around and I said, I can't go back to that corporate lifestyle in the same way that I was. So I started my business and purchased a machine that I had had done on myself when I was working corporate called the BioMeridian. I do health assessments. I'm able to work with people anywhere in the world in English. And that's been an evolution of learning Chinese medicine, learning Bach flower remedies, learning energy work, learning all sorts of different tools that somewhat are inspired by my clientele and somewhat are inspired by things that light me up. And all those things land in my health assessment as a toolbox that I can refer to based on the results of the test.
When you work with a client, what is there like a common goal, or is everything like very individual? Or
so it is a personalized process, but the things that light me up are helping people energetically with their, if they fall on the scale of empath or highly sensitive individual, I focus a lot on stress and inflammation and reducing that and balancing the body physically to support creating an optimum environment to live in inside their body. So inside and out, calming both, I guess.
Our podcast is really focused around sort of newer, diverse individuals, pretty much more at the mid-level to the higher level, you know, people who have what I call, we have our shit. But the one thing, yes, I can tell you for sure, and I've really learned this, I guess, later in life. I don't think because I got any wiser, just because, I don't know, I think there was just more material and more discussion about it, that food really impacted the way I felt. And I think it always did, but I wasn't smart enough, or there wasn't enough information when I was younger to really figure that out. So now I'm gluten-free, I'm dairy-free, I know that salt has a major impact on me, and not just the way I feel, but the way my brain works. And I'm sure you could explain that much better than we can. I mean, we're just on the fringes of this trying to figure it out.
Yeah, well, and interestingly enough, I think that our food has actually changed dynamically probably in the last 70 years officially, and more profoundly probably in the last 30 years. It was in the late 70s, early 80s that, you know, fast food hit hardcore. I remember being a young person getting to go to McDonald's on a Saturday.
Oh, me too. Yeah, yeah.
I never ate McDonald's. So.
Oh, my God. What do you mean? Oh, my God. Yeah. You're deprived.
No, I never liked it. So
it was set up as a treat in our household. We went for the Saturday errands, and that would be the thing that we possibly got to do. Mm-hmm. We weren't restaurant people. My mom would make us broccoli, a bowl of broccoli before we would have had pancakes as a treat. You know, if we had Kraft dinner, we had to have broccoli. I grew up as broccoli being the staple vegetable in our house. So I have this unique experience because my mom was also doing reflexology and she was a nurse and not really participating in the healthcare system because she had a very adverse reaction to a medication when I was young. And so that kind of tipped her scale to like, I need to support myself and fix myself. So my awareness of food, I really rebelled in my university days. and broccoli was never on my plate in university. And I ate horribly, and I didn't learn how to cook as a young person because our kitchen was too small. Mom didn't want us in the kitchen. So when I quit my job, I actually had time to learn how to cook. Right. We had our own garden. We lived in eating real food as a child most of the time, like 98% of the time. But that period between 17 and 36, my diet sucked, in all honesty, and my health deteriorated dramatically to precancerous cells and all sorts of aches and pains, right? So, you know, 3 burnout. In hindsight, you can look backwards and go, oh, stress plus poor diet equals illness. If you're dealing with whatever your weak spot is where the illness is going to happen, right? And so on the neurodiverse scale, the weak spot could be how your brain operate, how your digestion operate. Those two generally would be the places that a neurodiverse person would be affected, is in their digestive tract as well. Because your digestive tract is your second brain or your first brain, potentially.
What do you mean by that?
So we have heard more and more, if you are in certain circles, about the gut being a brain. So the wheat belly would probably talk about that. And so there are a lot of neurons. There are neurotransmitters that are actually created in the gut. The gut feeling would be another way that it operates as what we would call a brain, because we think of our intuition happening up here. So it is a diverse and understudied in a lot of places, as well as underutilized as a foundation of health.
Is that like the leaky gut thing too?
That is the leaky gut thing. That's the candida thing. That is the celiac anxiety connection. That is the heading down the gluten-free, dairy-free land, and all the symptomology that could be linked to that could be mood related or focus related, or how the brain's able to be less foggy or more clear, or, you know, all those different possibilities are because of how the gut is dealing with those ingestibles.
The last time we talked, you talked about the actual chemicals. I mean, I don't know, I won't try to explain like you did, but how the brain needs certain things, fats, protein. Can you explain that just so we can kind of get a sense of the science behind how this is all working?
Sure. And to be fair, my brain works like Pixar. That's how my brain is diverse. I like to simplify things, and it works in pictures. So I won't necessarily give you all of the deep level science terminology that you can go investigate if you're somebody that loves all that detail, so that you know where I'm at with it. I just find it's easier for people to map in their own body or in their own mind if you keep things simple. Our brain is made of fat, and every neurotransmitter is made of a fat and a protein. All our hormones are made of fats and proteins. Our brain is made of fat, but it's actually energized by sugar. So sugar is the first thing that will create energy. And sugar is not in like the white cane sugar, make a cookie or pour it on your cereal kind of sugar. I'm talking about glucose that is created when you actually break down a carbohydrate. Okay. Just to clarify, white cane sugar will make the same glucose, but digesting a carrot or digesting any carbohydrate will also make sugar. So when we take a look at some diets that particularly picky eaters will gravitate to, it's not necessarily diverse. And I find in my practice that a neurodiverse population tends to also have texture issues with their food, or they have very specific tastes that they cannot handle, like in terms of sweet, sour, pungent, bitter. They will gravitate to a particular type of food taste. And so it becomes a little bit of a mono diet for some neurodiverse people. And in doing that, they're not necessarily getting the diversity that creates the balance that can come from the diversity of eating enough fats, enough carbohydrates, enough proteins. And I mean, I think I'm going down a little different vein, but for some reason, based on your audience, this little piece needs to be said, because I don't think we talked this way when we talked originally. So I hope that makes sense to people.
Can you go deeper on that? Because you say that, you say carbs and proteins and fats, but so what's that mean as an eater? So here I am, I have some, you know, neurodiverse issues and anxiety, and, you know, I can get jittery and I can do all this, or I have brain fog, but are there things I should eat? Are there things I shouldn't eat? How do I find the balance of what I'm going to eat? How do, you know, even like you say, eat this, but it's never as simple as that. If I buy a roasted chicken at the grocery store, well, has it been soaked in salt and what spices are on? You just don't know all this stuff. How do you figure it out?
Yeah. So how you figure it out is do it yourself. The closest to Mother Nature that you can get your food, the better it is. I talk about happy eggs, and I think we talked about this before, and a happy egg comes from a happy chicken. So if people actually know people who have backyard chickens, what that chicken is actually fed is very different from what it would be fed in an industrial egg farm. And not only that, but the happiness and stress level of the chickens making factory farm eggs is different, which would affect their digestion, would affect their ability to make an egg that actually has a cross-section of nutrients. And I would challenge anybody to get a farm fresh egg and cook it side by side with a factory farm egg and check out the difference in the texture, check out the difference in the color of the yolk. So I would challenge anybody to do that. And the thing is, you can do that with almost any food in our spectrum at this point. We have made it such an industry in our food industry that we need to be profit oriented at a big factory level. And in order to be profit oriented, you're throwing more fertilizer, you're using the same land over and over again. You don't have trace minerals in the soil anymore. You're dealing with pesticides, herbicides, and possible gassing. You're picking the vegetables 3 months before they're ripe on the vine so that you can ship them places. There's like all these things that aren't necessarily labeled. You're genetically modifying stuff so that bugs don't eat it. What is it genetically modified? Is it modified with something that's a neurotoxin for you?
Yeah, because haven't I even heard about like have they spray crops with Roundup or something like that?
Yeah. Well, the other thing is it being sprayed on the forest? Is it in the water supply? Is it running through the crops streamwise? Is it in the air that lands on the crop next to the forest that's sprayed? Like all those things are things that aren't labeled or controlled ideally. So again, you're bringing up a good point because we've got two different observations about where is that allowed to be sprayed. It's not labeled.
No, it's not labeled that it's been sprayed with that, is it? No.
That part of why people need to be gluten-free, is it the aspect that we are fertilizing wheat in some cases with like copper, which is a neurotoxin for people? That's what happened with the Mad Hatters and created schizophrenia. Is it that it's genetically modified and our gut just doesn't know what the heck has arrived because it's no longer a grain that our caveman body knows what to do with, because we just don't evolve as quickly as what our food has evolved. As close to nature as you can get your food, like becoming a food snob is what I call it.
I think that's the only way you can do it, because I mean, I always talk about like, you know, I'm gluten sensitive, I can't do gluten, but it's not an accurate science. And if someone came to me a year from now and say, no, it's not gluten, it's what they spray it with, or it's this or that, I mean, I'd believe it.
It is really hard. And you can travel to Europe where this chemistry is not allowed on their food. I have a really good friend who, she was stage 4 cancer in Canada, like hyperreactive, bleeding out if she ate the wrong thing. Moved to France. She's been there 14 years, 15 years. Symptom-free.
Wow, that's amazing.
I know I feel better when I'm in Costa Rica. I'm eating more natural foods. I go to the market, and that's where I buy my meat. And it's like I say, it's that my eggs or the chicken has been running around in the backyard, and it's just all natural.
And you also cook a lot of your food when you're down there, too.
Oh, yeah, I do for sure. I have, and you know, when I go out to eat, and you know, I have like two or three restaurants that really work for me. They cook it the way I need it done, or they don't use certain ingredients. And I kind of restrict myself to that, which is hard because, you know, everyone's going out to this place and that place. And I kind of still go, but I hardly eat.
And I think that, again, the food aspect just, in my simplistic world, creates the inflammation potentially, and everybody's got a different weak spot. So somebody's weak spot might be headaches, somebody's weak spot might be pain, somebody's weak spot might be the gut. It, you know, like everybody's inflammatory weak spot and how it gets affected by what we're putting in our body or putting on our body, because it's even skincare or shampoo or toothpaste, like there's all sorts of chemistry there to be aware of. In Canada, we're allowed to spray our hamburger meat bright red.
What do you mean?
So next time you're in Canada and you're buying some hamburger meat, look at the color of it. If you were to buy hamburger at the market, it's going to be brown on the outside because it's oxidized.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks about it. Buying the nice fresh meat, you know, because it's bright red and looks pretty. And so we've gotten conditioned into pretty means it's better. Pretty doesn't mean it's better, because how long does that avocado last that's pretty?
It's the same with fruits too. And nobody wants to eat, you know, an ugly looking apple. And yet it's probably healthier than the big, nice, ripe, you know, shiny apple.
Right. How much wax is on it? What has it been sprayed with? When did it leave the tree? When did it ripen?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So we've been really conditioned, even from a body perspective, of the goal of perfection, which isn't reality. And so it's seeped down very much into our food.
Heather, the million-dollar question is, say there's someone listening to this podcast and they go, yeah, I really, really get it. I understand it and I buy into this. What do I do tomorrow? How do I start this journey of you know, eating right? Like, what's eating right mean? And what are the steps? How do I do that? How do I control my diet? How do I know what's in my diet? So on and so forth.
Well, this has been a journey of mine since I quit school. And there's a downside to it, because the food snob thing can lead you to a place where nothing is safe to eat. Bastardized our food so much at a collective level. So that has to be an awareness in somebody's radar. And like, if you're going out to a restaurant with friends, is that 90% of the time or is that 10% of the time? You know, moderation is important. What I do 80% of the time is going to be beneficial to my body 80%. So you go in with your eyes open. I'm not going to be perfect. It's okay. I'm going to just make baby steps and improve. And I'm going to maybe just start with the eggs. Maybe I'm just going to find an egg source. Like, you just start talking about it. And somebody will say, oh, my so-and-so, 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 you know, like 2 or 3 degrees of separation actually has backyard chickens. It's the weirdest thing. I don't know why they do it, but they have a backyard chicken for their kids or something. But you're going to find that source just by asking. So talk about it. Talk about your food. Talk about the red dye. Just start even talking about food and you will find people who recognize the same things, and they will have resources for you because they've noticed and they've hacked something and found a great butcher, or they found that they can do a mini garden inside and they're hydroponic gardening. Like, every person that you talk to, you may be educating them on looking at food differently, or they may have a resource for you. So it's creating some awareness for yourself, then just turning the dial up on that food snob thing. So if I find a cheese in a grocery store that's from France, knowing my friend in France has no problem eating the cheese and the bread, I'll buy that cheese. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different experience for me than buying a Canadian cheese, which sounds awful. I should be supporting local. I will also buy a cheese from a local market, but the stuff that's in the grocery store, I kind of become a grocery store snob. Which, does it add maintenance to my shopping? Yeah, a little bit, because I'm not doing what's normal, but it's okay with me because that's the payoff I want.
Like, no, I do the same thing when I'm in Canada. I mean, I really don't eat like chicken breasts from Costco or other grocery stores. I figure that, I mean, if every chicken breast is exactly the same size in every package in the store, somebody's doing something.
May I ask you a question? Should people start like keeping a food diary and keeping track of what they're eating, how they're feeling? I was telling Rick earlier that I've been going to a master herbalist for many, many years. And she was the one that straightened out my food, my stomach problems and my headaches and all of that, right? One of the things that she has me do is keep, when something starts bothering me, whether it's aches and pains or my stomach or something, keep a food diary and to see what it is that's bothering me.
Absolutely. If people have that sort of brain, that helps them to feel like they have control and they can actually look backwards. Like even looking back 3 or 4 days, what did I eat 3 or 4 days ago? It can be not necessarily immediately, but a food diary is a wonderful place to start with awareness. Don't search for perfection, search for improvement. And listen to what your body feels like. I'm like you, Rick. Dairy doesn't like me. I get stuffed up right away. I know if I've had an ice cream, I can eat what's called Sussex ice cream here, which is homemade ice cream at quote unquote a small commercial level. Homemade ice cream. It doesn't stuff me up because it doesn't have all the things you can't pronounce on the side of the carton. It's finding those joyful things, the French cheese or the homemade ice cream that somebody else has made. It's finding those little places of joy and experimenting with them because food needs to be joyful. Food needs to be something that isn't drudgery or overly restrictive, or it should have joy attached to it.
Oh, hallelujah. For sure. Yeah. So I guess the first is get started. Be sensitive to the foods you're eating. If things are bothering, and just I think just that sense to understand that if the stomach is upset, the brain's probably not getting, you know, what the brain needs to operate at its highest level.
Yeah, it makes me want to go back to keeping a diary again.
Yes, Heather, it was a pleasure to have you. Very, very insightful. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to really get a lot out of this episode.
I appreciate being able to share with you some insights that I've had through my own journey and my own life. And I hope that it does help people scratch the surface and improve their health and their awareness with what they put in their bodies and how it can affect them.
In closing, I'd like to ask all atypicals to consider how food might impact your brain function, your mood, and your anxiety level. It's just another step into trying to maximize your true potential. Thanks for joining us today and listening to another episode of Atypical Leader. If you haven't already done so, like, share, and follow me on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. By liking and sharing, you will help other atypicals find all of us, so we can all start to leverage the stories, strategies, and strengths of what make us all unique. Keep listening and remember, take charge and push away those self-doubts. Leverage what we're talking about. Be confident in who you are and proud of what makes you unique. So join me, Rick Brennan, and my co-host Judy Sims on the next episode of The Atypical Leader. And don't forget to get your copy of the book, The Atypical Leader, Harnessing the Power of Neurodiversity on Amazon. To learn more about us, leadership, and neurodiversity, please go to our website, atypicalleader.com.
Thanks for listening. Let's do it again next week.